And hey, maybe, just maybe, one day you'll get to hear...
Panda, say I love you.
KPP Concerts and CFRC 101.9 FM present a stacked lineup of shows this October at the Broom Factory featuring some of your favorite big-name acts and a few local gems as well. On October 18th, it's a hometown rock show as the Wilderness hit the stage with support from the Astros. October 19th sees Kingston's own Luscious welcome Feral Minx from Hamilton to the Broom with local rockers Pound Salt getting things started early. On October 24th, don't miss Canadian folk musician Ben Kaplan with an opening set by Kingston's Princess Towers. On October 25th, indie darling Sky Wallace comes to town. For additional information and to buy tickets, visit kppconcerts.com. See you there.
G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's A Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs as well as CFRC, so thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify and CFRC Podcast. So no excuses, I say, to not hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to Kennedy Quigg, who is doing a Master of Science in Chemistry / Chemistry Biology under the supervision of Dr. Graham Howe. Welcome to Grad Chat, Kennedy.
Thank you so much, CJ. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on the show. And, you know, before we started this interview, we were just chatting about the differences of, you know, writing for people in your field versus writing to the general public, which is a little bit different.
Yes.
And so as we go through, there will be some words that Kennedy will explain to us.
I'll do my best.
To make it easier, because when you're in chemistry, all you can think about is the chemical listing of everything and how it all gets joined together. See, I can't even say it myself, and how all that works. But first of all, what brought you to working in chemistry and specifically chemical biology?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking. It's been a bit of a winding journey.
Oh, has it?
It has. I started my undergrad in biology thinking that I wanted to be like a field biologist.
Right.
Because I love being outside. And then I realized I didn't really love the ecology courses so much, and that there might be a distinction between what you like to do in your free time and what you like to learn.
Yes.
At school. So I then changed into life science in my third year and was kind of thinking about medical school, but I really enjoyed like the biochemistry side of things.
Right.
And so I wanted to try research. So in my fourth year, I did an independent study research project.
Okay.
Which is basically for students who aren't specialization students. So if you're not in the research stream,
right.
Which requires additional courses that I hadn't taken at that point. So I did an independent study and I asked Dr. David Zetchel to supervise me. So he's a chemistry professor and he was actually my orgo professor. I noticed that when he was teaching the organic chemistry, he had kind of a more biological approach to it or how it applied to biology. So I did some research under him and I enjoyed it. And then that kind of led me to meeting Dr. Howe. And I just figured I'm enjoying this and it seems like I've got a good opportunity. So I just kind of went with it from there.
That's great that you did an independent project, because not many people would take that on, not when they're at university. It's like, do the courses I have to and get finished.
Yeah, it definitely had its challenges. I've had to, like, at that time, that was only the third chemistry course that I had taken was the research course. So
right.
I've had to do a bit of legwork on my own, and I continue to do that now throughout my master's. So
did you have to pick up some extra ones as well to be able to get into a Master of Science?
I didn't need any other prerequisites, which is great, but it's more so like they assume you have a certain amount of base knowledge. So
right.
If there's anything that I'm lacking, then I have to kind of make sure I'm up to snuff on that.
Well, I think it's interesting too, because a lot of people think when they're going to grad studies, mm-hmm. you have to have everything and you have to be top of your class and every course has to be in relation to your field that you've chosen. Mm-hmm. But you've just proven that's not always the case.
Yeah.
And I think therefore people shouldn't be scared to think about, can I move over into a different field? Yeah. And you can't do it on everything.
Right.
But there are times, as you've proven, that you can.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting experience. And that's the cool thing about grad school is you can really work with your supervisor and make it an experience that you want to have, whether it's your research or doing things like this too.
Right.
So
I guess we should get on to what you're actually doing. Well, before I give you the first question, you explain what your research topic is. Did you choose this topic or was it chosen for you? Because that happens sometimes in grad studies, particularly in STEM disciplines.
Yes.
The project is chosen for you.
That's a good question. It was a bit of a combination of both. So for my undergraduate, for my fourth year thesis, I was working on a similar project, so finding...
Right.
Well, I'm going to give a spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Go for it.
Okay. So that my fourth year thesis was trying to find an enzyme to degrade polystyrene, styrofoam, which is a type of plastic.
Right.
But it fell under this larger umbrella of trying to find a biological catalyst to degrade plastic.
Right.
And I wanted to stay in that field, and then Dr. Howe had an opening for the specific project that I'm on now. So it was kind of serendipitous.
Serendipitous. That was the word I was looking for. Serendipitous. I was going to say fortuitous as well, but serendipitous is probably the better one.
Yes.
Well, that's great because, like I said, not a lot of people always get to do exactly what they want to do. So you can with this. So, okay, your research topic is, and hopefully I get all the words right, discovery and characterization of putative thermostable enzymes for the degradation of polyether polyurethane foam.
Yes.
I was stuck on the fourth word, or fifth word, anyway, but you're going to explain that to me anyway. So as we know, you know, there's a lot of lab work based on problems that need to be resolved, either as to why something happens, how can we make a process perhaps more efficient or cost effective, or this is not working, so what else can we do? Mm-hmm. So can you give us an overview of your project by starting out with what is the problem or issue you are looking at and why is it important to look at this more closely?
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of thrown it all out there for you.
Thank you, CJ. Well, I probably could have made that title a bit more digestible, so.
Well,
my
that's
apologies.
Coming in there, though, isn't it? The digestible.
Yeah, there we go. No pun intended.
Yeah.
So I'm part of a team of researchers, and our title is, the project that we're all working on is called Open Plastic.
Right.
Which is, it's actually an international consortium of researchers who are all trying to find biological ways to degrade plastic waste and to also upscale that so that hopefully we can do that on an industrial level.
Right.
And it's called Open Plastic because we share our findings with each other and we meet yearly and we collaborate.
Well, that's great.
Yeah. So we're really pushing for this, which is exciting. So basically the reason why we're interested in this research is, as everyone knows, plastics are
everywhere.
They're everywhere, and the main properties that make them so useful to us in that they're very tolerant of heat, they are durable, they last a long time. That obviously all has a negative effect once they're in landfills or in the ocean.
Great. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
We'll break down.
Exactly. But what's fascinating is that in some of these plastic waste sites, you'll find biofilms or things that are attached to the plastic, like as it's sitting in the soil, as it's sitting in the ocean, it might accumulate some sort of algae or whatever is attached to the surface of the plastic. And what we're doing is looking at the microbes that are actually in those plastic waste sites and looking at their metabolism and seeing if they are actually breaking down this plastic.
So you're looking at the algae, seeing it.
Well, there's different types of basically sites that we sample from.
Right.
But we can look at the genome of whatever organism might be growing on or around the plastic. And then based on its genome, we can find the function of the protein that might be present there. And then we basically, on different levels, we can assess if it's growing on this plastic. It must be using it for something. So is it breaking it down?
Right, right.
Or is it just making smaller pieces of the plastic?
Right.
So there's a lot of interesting cases with this, but...
Couldn't you just reverse how plastic's made somehow?
Well, a lot of...
Or was that clearly too simplistic?
Well, that's a great question. Since a lot of plastics are very tolerant of heat, it takes a lot of energy to melt them or to degrade them.
Okay.
And that's also releasing... like greenhouse gases into the atmosphere,
right,
and
right.
producing toxic byproducts. So that is being done, but if we could find a better alternative, then that would be ideal.
Yeah, because clearly that hasn't been working.
Yes.
Because we've still got all these plastics.
Yes.
Everywhere. Can I ask, are all plastics the same? Because you talked about styrofoam, which to me looks very different to a plastic bag.
Exactly. That's a great question, and that's a key component of the Open Plastic Project, is we actually divide our research based on the type of plastic. So some people might be looking specifically at styrofoam. Others may be looking at polyethylene terephthalate, also known as PET.
Oh, they're the bottles?
Yes,
the plastic
bottles? Exactly.
The PET bottles?
Exactly, PET bottles. I'm specifically looking at polyurethane, which we can get to later. But all plastics are not equal as far as from a biocatalyst point of view. Some of them are easier to break down depending on their chemical structure.
Right.
If it's easier to basically react with, or if it's more inert or unreactive. So the PET bottles, actually, there's been a lot of progress made there. There's a European company called Carbios, if I'm pronouncing that wrong.
Either way.
They've found an enzyme from a plastic waste site, and they've upscaled it to the point where they can break down a plastic bottle and then remake it from the monomers that
The ones that be made into clothes and all sorts of other things.
Like recycling plastic.
Yeah.
Exactly. If you can break it down and then use those broken down products to remake the same thing, that's the true definition of
recycling.
Right.
But you want to go one step further than that, break them down and just have them gone for good.
Well, either would be great if we can find a biological way to break them down. That's better than using really high temperatures and pressures.
Mm-hmm.
If once we break them down, we can reuse those monomers and remake either the same plastic or something else, then that would be even better.
One of the problems I would say is that when you talked in the synopsis you gave us, you know, these plastics are getting into the various waterways, whether it's the oceans, whether it's the streams, mm-hmm. and things. But then there's the other side, the plastics that are in the landfills.
Mm-hmm.
Would, again, that be mean you're looking at different, apart from the type of plastic,
mm-hmm.
the environment that the plastic is suddenly found itself in, if it's in salt water, would mm-hmm. that mean something different? They'd need something different to something that's being stuck in fresh water, or
mm.
I mean, maybe I'm going too far.
That's a great question. Yeah, I think there could be an interesting study done on what type of organisms may be metabolizing or likely to metabolize the plastic mm-hmm. in those different environments, like. Maybe in a saltwater environment, it's like it would happen faster or slower.
Right.
That's not something that I've thought about, actually, but that's a great question.
There you go.
Maybe we should take that into account. But what's interesting is even if the organism itself is different, the enzyme that is within that organism could be the same. So it could be
right.
using the same mechanism. And my research is mainly on the enzymatic level. So that's...
Okay, so we better get on to your work.
Okay.
Well, first of all, can I ask, what are putative thermostable enzymes? So something to do with heat enzymes?
Yes, of course. So in the HAL lab, a large part of what we do is trying to discover new enzymes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the word putative comes in, meaning that I don't, for example, say I want to discover an amidase enzyme, which breaks down amide bonds, which are carbon to nitrogen.
Okay, right. I know those words.
Yes. That's the main part of the amide linkage. But if I want to discover an amidase enzyme, I don't know for sure that it's an amidase until I go through all the necessary testing. So
okay.
What we have been, basically at the heart of what we do is, as far as the plastics project, if there are enzymes that have been published that we know perform a certain reaction,
mm-hmm.
we basically take the sequence, the protein that basically the protein sequence of that enzyme.
Right.
And we try to find, basically using online tools, we find other sequences that are very similar to that.
Okay.
And then we just basically order them online, which is the amazing thing about doing science these days.
I just want one sequence of this, thanks very much.
Yeah, it's like ordering a latte, but it's a protein. So we basically, and what we try to do is, if we find a sequence of a protein that's similar to one that's published that we want to basically try, like replicate that, we try to pull that protein sequence from an organism that natively grows in thermophilic locations. So either in...
And thermophilic locations are...
So this would be like basically an underwater sea vent that could be really hot.
Right.
Or like, yeah, any... We honestly, the science behind it is we look for an organism that has therm in the name. And we're like, well, that must
be
good enough.
You got to start somewhere, right? Because it is all trial and error.
Exactly. So those are the protein candidates that we pull from, and we order those sequences. And then we, depending on the project, we screen them on different model chemical compounds that are most similar to the plastic that we want to then see if the enzyme reacts with. So the putative is meaning we don't know for sure that this enzyme is an amidase or whatever other enzyme. And then the thermostable is that we're hoping that this enzyme, if it comes from an organism that grows in a hot location, maybe this enzyme will withstand higher heat.
Right.
Because that is useful for then upscaling on an industrial level.
Which is ultimately what you want to be able to do to tackle the amounts of rubbish out there or plastics out there.
Yes, that's the ultimate goal.
And what about this bit? What's the difference between polyether and polyurethane?
Right. So as I mentioned, the plastic that I'm looking at is polyurethane, which is most commonly used in, there's different types of polyurethane. Some of it is like a chemical sealant, like if you're ever like staining your deck or like polyurethane paint, like is like in that kind of liquid form. There's also like mattresses and foam that are made from polyurethane as well.
You don't even think about those, do you? I just think plastic bags and plastic bottles.
Exactly. So where the polyether comes in is, the poly part is describing the polymer, and ether is the linkage, the chemical linkage that links all the polymers together, or all of the monomers that make a plastic polymer.
Can I ask one more question before we go into this? And maybe this will come anyway. So to make these plastics in the first place, they were synthesized or whatever. They weren't natural products per se. It was done in the lab.
Yep, this is all synthetic.
Synthetic.
Yep.
So again, I guess I'm coming back to think, can we not make up a synthetic solution?
Yeah, like can we design something?
As opposed to looking at a live enzyme.
Can we design like a plastic that is just, that breaks down better on its own?
Or breaks, goes in, you put it in the water and it mixes with that plastic and does its job.
This is a great point, but then is it going to serve the purpose that we want? Like if we design a plastic for...
To eat the other plastics.
For a plastic water bottle, and then you put water in the plastic water bottle, and then it just degrades over time.
Yeah.
Then it's not serving the plastic purpose that we want. So I think that's the main
problem.
And it's a great... Someone at our most recent symposium with all of the Open Plastic team made the point of, like, why don't we just use paper cups or paper straws? But, of course, they get flimsy over time because...
Right.
Paper is biological.
We are going back to paper.
We are starting to go back.
You know, we had this great big thing. Oh, plastics, everything, And now even the grocery stores, you're going back to paper bags. And
if everyone could just do that, then I can graduate. I'll get out of here.
Okay, everyone. You've heard it on the show.
That would be great.
Get rid of your plastics, just use paper. Well, it makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Although there's other issues with that too. Okay, so why is enzymatic recycling an important and viable option for plastic degradation, valorization, and upcycling? Okay, you might have to explain some of those.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to finish what I was saying about the polyether.
Oh, yes.
The only reason, basically what that means is that I'm looking at foam products. So it's usually... The polyether, polyurethane is normally what is used to make like foam mattresses and pillows and stuff like that.
Right.
And it's also harder to degrade than other types of polyurethane. So there's kind of a gap in that field.
Which is good to be looking at.
Yeah, which is why we're looking at that. And then to answer your second question, I think we've already kind of talked about it a bit. Enzymatic degradation is hopefully a more, environmentally friendly process and also economically friendly.
Right.
And hopefully, would not be as harmful to the planet as what is currently being done, which is really high pressures and temperatures as far as breaking down.
Which is not efficient and
exactly
expensive, et cetera.
And enzymes can be produced at a mass scale. And so then as far as breaking down and valorizing the plastic, or I guess adding value to it, what's cool about enzymes is that, if we use the right type of enzyme, and if we use an enzyme and we pair it with a plastic that is that contains a chemical bond that enzyme really wants to break down, then we can reliably get the same breakdown products. And if we get that over and over, perhaps that's a better solution to upcycling the plastic, because then we can
reuse them instead.
Exactly, which is already being done with plastic water bottles, which is absolutely incredible. And so it's kind of killing two birds with one stone. Hopefully the breakdown process is more eco-friendly, and then you can upcycle from there.
We keep hearing about the word microplastics everywhere, mm-hmm. in our bodies and in the animals and things.
Mm-hmm.
So using enzymes to degrade plastic,
mm-hmm.
is that actually getting rid of it totally, or is it still around and therefore whatever little algae or whatever gets taken up by a fish or mm-hmm. whatever, it's still there, you just can't see it?
Yeah, no, and that's something that we in the chemistry department are looking at. There is actually a really fascinating case of, I think they're just little mealworms that actually tunnel into polystyrene. They make holes in the styrofoam. And when you cut open their guts, there's little pieces of styrofoam in there. So they technically they're eating it, but are they actually breaking it down? So that's something.
Because then something else will eat them, right?
Of course. And that now we have microplastics.
Right.
So maybe on the surface, it looks really cool that they're tunneling in the styrofoam, but that is an issue that we're concerned about. And of course, maybe enzymes aren't perfect, and maybe they're producing a chemical byproduct that is not useful or toxic. So that is definitely a concern. But hopefully, if they are producing microplastics, we can just collect those and recycle them into something else.
That's the way to go, isn't it? To whatever's out there already in plastics, to find a way to recycle them better.
Yes.
And more efficiently.
Yes. So it's kind of a two-part problem, but we're definitely, microplastic is not something we want to produce more of. So that's something we're keeping an eye out for.
Choose other products to use, but use these where we can recycle.
Yes.
Okay. So, you've kind of answered this one too, but let's just go for it. How does polyurethane compare to other plastic types, and why is it important that we recycle polyurethane? And you've mentioned some of those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we kind of like to categorize plastics into two different types, one being hydrolyzable, one being non-hydrolyzable.
Which means?
So hydrolyzable means that this plastic can be broken down with an enzyme in the presence of water.
Okay.
So that sounds like a pretty easy thing to do. And the plastic water bottles are hydrolyzable, which makes sense why they're kind of ahead of all the other plastic types.
Yes.
And so polyurethane falls into the non-hydrolyzable category, which really just comes down to its chemical composition as to why it's not hydrolyzable. And it's actually one of, if I'm remembering correctly, it's one of the most commonly produced non-hydrolyzable plastics.
Okay.
So it makes up a large part of that category.
Right.
And specifically polyether polyurethane, within all of the polyurethanes, it's at least 50%. So it's quite an important plastic that we need to
figure out what to do with.
Yes. So because if you think about it, foam is
it's everywhere.
Common, insulation, bedding, all that good stuff that we need.
Yeah, all those things. Oh, this is the most comfy bed I've ever had. Oh, guess what?
I'm going to use that.
Don't get rid of it. You've got it for life.
Yeah, send that to me.
So where are you at with your project now? And what are your, I guess, your long-term goals for your future with this research? Because, I mean, you've already said there is so much that still needs to be done. The fact you have this open plastic consortium, that's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
But as you said, there's lots of different types of plastics.
Yes, exactly. So I'm going into my second year of my master's and hoping to graduate next year. That's the goal. So right now, up until now, I've screened probably about, well, there's quite a lot of, I think I had 15 different enzymes that I was starting off with.
Right.
And about five of them made it past a couple initial steps.
That's good.
And then it's been narrowing down and now I'm at one.
That happens.
So we kind of, we go through a lengthy process, which involves getting this sequence of DNA to then be a physical protein we can have in our hands.
Right.
And then testing that with basically compounds that look like polyurethane. And based on that, I have one enzyme that I'm now currently testing with actual polyurethane, like liquid dispersions.
How exciting.
And it is looking promising so far, which is nothing new in literature. This all has been done before, but I think what's exciting is we're really trying to see exactly how it's breaking down polyurethane.
Right.
And that's still a big unknown in the literature. So
you look at each step as you're going through it. So it's past this check and then you go to this check.
Yes.
And has it passed that? Yep, great. Let's go on to the next thing. And each time you're sort of saying, yep, yep, yep. Ooh, maybe.
Exactly. And there are...
And what was the difference between from yes to just the maybe?
So actually one of my it was really down to two at one point, and one of them was really easy to purify and get just this enzyme, and it was stable at high temperatures, but then it just wasn't really reacting to the extent that I wanted it to with the model compounds and with polyurethane dispersions. So the one I'm currently working with, it's very hard to purify, and I'm not quite sure yet if it's stable at higher temperatures, but it degrades polyurethane quite well. So I'm moving forward with that one because the most important thing is breaking down the polyurethane.
Mm-hmm.
And for the next year or so, we want to make sure that this protein is pure in large quantities. And once it is pure, we can do a full characterization and see like what pH it's stable at as far as acidity or basicity, what temperatures it's stable at. And then really the cherry on top is knowing exactly how it's breaking the polyurethane, so knowing the mechanism.
Right.
And figuring out what the degradation products are. And once we know what they are, we can figure out if they can be reused, if they're valuable. That would be the perfect idea for the next year.
To finish it, yes.
Yeah, to hopefully leave it in a place where I can publish what I've done and someone else can pick it up and take it from there.
Yeah, still going. So it's interesting that you say that. So you're looking at it so far, but then when you do find, hopefully you do find one, then it still comes down to, can you reproduce this in quantities and whatever the next steps are to still make it efficient and cost effective? Because you're looking at industrial scale things, because you might have found the enzyme, but then what?
Yes. Kind of thing. Yeah, of course. And that would be, you know, as far as making this enzyme, like a commercial enzyme, like that would probably be a very long process, way longer than me. Like maybe, I don't know how long, like 5 to 10 years.
Right.
But I think what's important is that if I can just add to the body of literature, and, you know, there's only really like, as far as I know, there's like one or two published enzymes that are doing what I'm trying to do, which is break down the polyether-based polyurethane.
That's good.
Like there is a lot of data of the strain of the microbe and what type of bacteria it might be, but on the enzymatic level, there's not a lot published. So if I can, you know, add to that and show that we've discovered a new enzyme that can do this, then maybe that will help someone else down the line, and hopefully it can be upscaled up to the industrial level at some point.
So I wish you the best in everything, Kennedy. I know whatever you produce, it's going to be awesome. As you said, the literature is going to be thankful for your part that you're playing in this this part of what this plastic world has come to be. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. And hopefully there's some good results down the line.
I'm sure there will be.
Yes.
That we'll always get there in the end.
Yes, of course.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Sego.
Buju Anim.
Danach A. Ak Anzenu Shukwithan.
Tanse.
Ay, Inuhadikay.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Hey friend, welcome to Words and Culture. This is the Anishinaabe episodes and I'm your host, Melissa Spence. Like I mentioned in our previous episodes, I worked as a radio DJ for years and I got to know a lot of Indigenous artists through their art, through their interviews, and through their live performances. One artist in particular whom I recall being so gentle and loving during my very early days as a nervous interviewer was Cheyenne Havorka. You may recall one of her tunes called Can't Change the World from the hit show Blackstone that aired back in 2011. How's that for a throwback? Cheyenne Havorka is an award-winning songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, humanitarian, and performer. And when I say music was her passion, I meant it. She holds an honors bachelor of music in education and a master's in education. And despite it being well over a decade since we last spoke, it was like only a couple years had gone by. So what has she been up to? Well, I asked, but first, and like we always do in the Indigenous community, often we are asked to introduce ourselves. This way people know who we are and where we come from. I asked Cheyenne to do just that.
Bonjour, Indigen. Makate Benesi, Indigenous Kazmasquatas, and Dondem. Opoganajik, Nojibagai, Matachuan, and Miigwech for allowing me to speak today.
So, Cheyenne, obviously you're a musician and you're someone whom, if anyone's been paying attention to Indigenous music for the past 20 years, have heard your name. Tell us a little bit about how you became who you are in the early days. Let's start there.
So I don't know actually how many people know how I ended up on the music path. Like, I've always been one of these people who kind of follow where I believe I'm being led to be, spiritually, by creator, whatever it is that makes sense to you. And I remember I was an educator in a grade 7-8 class, and I'm in this class and this letter came across my desk, and it was about elders coming into the community to give spirit names. And so this young group of youth that I was working with really wanted to go, and it was a Friday night, and that's back in my like mid-20s. So I had a very different approach to life at that time, especially on a Friday. But I really cared about my students and I really wanted to do well by them. And at that point in my learning journey, like, I did feel like very tied to the land and tied to my culture, and was starting to like re-engage with that with the elders in the community up north. So I went to the naming ceremony, and they did it through a sweat lodge. There was a lot happening in that lodge, and nothing was happening to me, but that was okay because I was there for the kiddos, not for me. And then the second round, because there was kids there, or youth, I should say, like 12, 13, 14-year-olds, they gave us a break. And the second time I came in, that's when things started to happen for me. And one of the things that I have been told I can share is I first saw this big lightning bolt come down, and it grabbed all the rocks, the grandmothers and grandfather rocks, and pulled them off the ground, and then they dropped. And again it happened, and this time this great big bird came through, black bird came through and flew out, and again nobody said anything. So anyway, the next day we're at the powwow, and the elder came up and he was speaking in Anishinaabe Mo'an, and, you know, I'm on my learning journey with the language, right? But I knew he was talking about me. And then, you know, so my name had come through, and then he said, you know, it came out as Makde Benesi, and it was Black Thunderbird. And I was just like so honored because I wasn't there for my name. I was there for the kids. And this is important because this is where my journey actually started musically. I had loved music. I'd, you know, taken piano lessons and singing lessons and joined the high school band and took on extra jobs so that I could drive myself to more lessons. Like, I love music. So I got home and I'm in my 20s and I pulled out my favorite piano book just to practice in the afternoon before going for the evening ceremonies. And this piece of paper fell out from when I was 13. And it was this poem I had written about thunderstorms. And I'd completely forgotten about this poem. And it was all about how I loved to be in the thunderstorm where it could, you know, the storm could hide my heartbreaking and the rain could hide my tears and the wind could hold me and the lightning would like light the way for me. So I turned that into a song that afternoon, and that became like the debut song on the Thunderbird album, which is the album that started my journey. Years later, I felt like Creator was pushing me back into education again because like people started offering me jobs in a time where teaching jobs are very difficult to get. And so I took that as my calling to go back. And then I had my child, he's 8 now, and got into a lot of land-based learning at the same time. I knew I couldn't, you know, be a new mom, an educator, self-sustaining, and a touring musician. So I took a step back from the stage, but I still wrote music. And I feel like in the last 2 years, like I'm writing more and being pulled more. Yes, I'm just kind of being pulled back into it again. And so I'm not sure what Creator's got planned, but here I am.
That's such a beautiful story about how you got your name and how you're following your path like in a heart-centered way, which is truly how we are supposed to be living, right? Like that's supposed to guide us. And I was curious as to where you were these past few years as well. You kind of just, I don't know, I guess I thought you just took a break or whatever, but thanks for clearing that up. You know, that's a really great thing to commit yourself to for these past few years. That's a beautiful story about your name. Did anybody else in the ceremony see what you saw? Like, do you know to this day if anybody saw that?
No, nobody saw what I saw and I didn't see what anybody else saw, but funny enough, there was one gentleman in there and he has given me permission because now we became connected through that sweat lodge. During the first half would all of a sudden start crying and saying Asema, like to the fire keeper outside. And I was just like, wow, like he's experiencing something very, very real. And then the second time he was crying so much, he had to leave and I never knew why. And then like the next day, he felt compelled to give me an eagle feather. That was my very first eagle feather. So the elders help us do like the exchange. And I still carry that feather. It was approximately 6 years after that sweat lodge where we just randomly connected on Facebook again. And I had just, because I'm a 60 scoop survivor, right? So I was pulled off community when I was 6, almost 7. So I remember who my home community was. But I wasn't allowed to reconnect until we were older, right? So, and then really, I just didn't realize all I had to do was call the band office and everybody remembered me and I knew them. And it was just like, boom, I reconnected to one of my uncles. And I said, like, I'm kind of hoping to find out what my clan is because now I have, you know, my name, but I'd had the name already for 6 years. And my uncle lived out in the bush lots and only came out every now and then. And he's just like, oh yeah, well, we're Turtle Clan. And he was the only uncle that knew that because everybody else was kind of disconnected. And so I had found out it was Turtle Clan. And then I connected with this other fella that was there in the sweat lodge. And he's like, she was looking for you. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like Grandmother Turtle kept coming out of the rocks and was asking me to find somebody. I didn't know who she was looking for, but I guess like Grandmother Turtle was physically like touching him and it was too much for him. So.
Wow. That's incredible. I'm also Turtle Clan.
Are you? We're sisters.
Shout out to the Turtle Clans. I know I've met some people in Arizona who are Turtle Clan, and it was really comforting to meet others as well. Like they were all over the place, right? Like it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. So I'm a daughter of a 60 scoop. So I know that my mother was removed from her community when she was probably around the same age as you, and she lost her language in this foster home, right? She went in speaking fluent Ojibwe. and came out only being able to understand it. So I wanted to ask, what was your relationship like to the language before that? Do you have any recollection of that or culture in general?
Yes. We weren't fluent, but it's like a mishmash of that. And I think there's a couple French words in there too, because like I never ever heard it before, but like most of it was like 50-50 English Anishinaabemowin. And then when we went to the first foster home, I was very confused because it was all, I only knew part of the language. And then when we were adopted, so I would have been 7, almost 8 at that point. And we grew up in Steinbeck, and like the school had half days in German and half days in English. And I really didn't know what's going on. So I lost a lot of the Anishinaabemowin. And then when we moved up to Red Lake, there's like lots of Anishinaabe people up there, right? And Oji-Cree people. And I was waitressing at the Lakeview restaurant there. And, you know, I hear the language at the tables being spoken. All of a sudden I started to remember something like, hey, did you just say to go over in the canoe? And the guy looked at me and he's like, how'd you know that? And I'm like, I don't know. It's just like, I remember that from something. And so I'd ask if I could just sit and listen, you know, just to try, because it sounded so familiar. It felt familiar. And I started to recall some of the words. And now I'm just on my learning journey to try to gain more, learn more, but it's, there's a big responsibility with the language, because it's not like just knowing a word for a word for a word. There's like so much meaning and impact and like ancient knowledge really in each and every part of that word that tells you more than just, you know, that's a Labrador bush, like tells you its location, what they're used for, where you can find them. Oh, I said that already. What part of the plant you're using, it's built right into the name. So that's where I'm at now, is like I'll recognize the word, but I don't always know all the meanings, like those. And so that's what I'm learning now. And especially when I'm out on the land, like I really want to understand every part so that knowledge of that plant is coming with the word, you know?
Yes. A lot of the conversations I've been having is revealing to me, someone who doesn't speak the language and is trying to learn. It's more than just learning, you know, the basics of the word. There's so much description. There's almost even a spirit or an essence behind the word, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And so certainly I'm not fluent, but on my, like as a second language learner or a language learner, I'm not sure how you, an ELL learner, however you would classify me with the early language stuff. And, you know, like now with my son, like it's a big part of our day. Like every morning we get up and we go for a walk through the bush, and it's about a half mile. And then we're lucky enough to have this natural stream that grows on the yard. And so I have a cup set up there, a little cup that doesn't rust, stainless steel. And we take a dip out of that spring every morning, and we say our prayers in Anishinaabe, and he does too. But then we try to learn something along the way too. Like, what are we going to learn about? And then, you know, we'll talk to some language speakers and use other resources, usually people, like our living libraries that are willing to share and learn more. And then we talk about that the next time we're out and take some time to engage with the plant and engage with that outdoor part of what we're learning about, depending on like what season it is. We'll also have an impact on what it is we're going to learn about. And we try to speak in Anishinaabemowin. Primarily, and our prayers are always in Anishinaabemowin Itta, right?
That's so beautiful. I'm really curious to hear how it's coming back, right? Like it sounds like it's like this essence that's coming back to you slowly, and I've heard other people say you need to live the language in order for you to really get it and to really become fluent. It's not just reading books and doing workshops. You really have to live in it, like you said, going and praying in it and visiting the land and really, really taking stock of everything around you and translating it.
Yeah. And like, I do believe that for me anyway, like everybody has their own way of connecting with the world around them. But I find that when I'm out on the land, especially after like my prayer and that, I don't know what it is about that morning prayer, that greeting of the sun and drinking of the water. And then when we're walking back, like the words almost come easier. And, allowing yourself, and I'm going to say it this way, allowing yourself to speak in the language with the world around you makes a very big difference right? And just being okay with leaving the English behind. Because it does, it starts to like clean up in there. It's almost like cobwebs being, and all of a sudden a word will just pop out and you're like, oh yeah, that's how, I think that's how we said that. Like, well, I'm 48 now. Well, I will be 48 in a month, but that's, my memory serves correctly, 45 years ago. I'm sure this is how my uncle had said it or my gookum had said it.
I was talking about music yesterday and how a lot of the language, and not just Anishinaabe Moen, but different languages are being translated into children's songs to make it easier for people to absorb. And I wanted to go into music with you and what you've been working on lately. So how has the language affected your music now?
How it started was a musician friend of mine, Micah, who is not Indigenous, but has spent a lot of time considering what his role is in Canada, or what he calls Canada, and he always does the quotation marks, which I appreciate, as a settler, and in his capacity of being a musician, what does reconciliation look like for him? So he asked me if I would be willing to write this piece with him called Grandmother Song, which this Anishinaabe song that I wrote is kind of like encompassing this entire other piece. He grew up on the land. So like he has like similar connections, but from a very, very different viewpoint. And his family grew up with other Anishinaabe families. And he was kind of like, their family was like the non-Indigenous family in this community. And they never claimed or tried to claim any form of indigeneity at all. They just grew up in that kind of setting. So he gets it. So he wanted to write this piece, and it's a story. So there's barely any singing throughout the piece. And it starts off with this young girl talking about how her grandmother shares the songs with her. And there's one song that she just starts to sing, but she never finishes it. And, you know, it reminds me of Leanne Goose. You know Leanne.
Yeah.
Because she was part of my music thesis, actually, like years ago. And she had said to me, she's just like, well, the songs aren't ours. They come to us through the spirits, right? Like, and that always stuck with me. Eh? Like, I love Leanne. But anyway, and so the essence of the song that the grandmother says, she's like, no, it's going to come to you eventually, but I don't know when. And so that little chant comes in and out of the whole storyline. And it talks about this young girl who's like walking these two worlds, right? So she's walking this traditional life of learning from her gookum and her mom slowly, like the seven teachings. I think it takes place over 6 or 7 years when you add up all the years throughout the storyline. And very land-based learning. But then her other being needs to go to school in the colonial setting and live through those experiences of being in a colonial setting. So you can just follow her just zigzagging really through these two worlds. And when she's out on the land, like when the opportunities come out, the grandmother will give her another teaching based on one of the seven teachings. And in the end, just before she gets the final teaching, which is love in this storyline, the grandmother passes away. And she didn't get the final teaching. So there's this great big epic thing that happens. And then after that, the spirit of grandmother kind of pops into her head and the rest of the song comes out. And so that's where the seven teaching songs come out. And so I actually wrote that, or that I should say, that song came to me when Micah placed this idea to me. That song came to me. And I said, well, this is what just came to me the night. And so that main melody comes in and out. It's woven through like a musical motif throughout this. It's about a 48 minute piece, spoken word, not spoken word, like storytelling, I should say, with an orchestra background, ending with just hand drums and voice with this piece.
Well, let's take a listen to the full song. This is Grandmother's Song, or Gookum Song, by Cheyenne Havorka.
Hey,
grandmother's song, or Kukum song, by the beautiful Cheyenne Havorka. When I tell you I felt that on a cellular level, I mean that combination of Anishinaabe Moen with the drum reached a part of me that a lot of music these days does not. There really is that essence of spirit when we speak or sing in the language. And I have no doubt that our ancestors are always there, nudging us down the path, no matter how subtle or obvious it might be. Our dreams, for example, have been the meeting place for so many of my own encounters with ancestors. So when I hear a story like Cheyenne told about spirit gifting us messages and teachings as we journey through life, I know exactly what she's talking about. We're also clan sisters, so maybe that has something to do with it as well. At the very end of every episode, we like to present three words to our listeners that they can learn on the spot.
Well, I think Minobamadizwin would be a good one. Just that walking of that good life, right?
Can you repeat it and then I'll repeat it after you?
Mino.
Bimadizwin.
Bimadizwin. Yeah, Minobamadizwin.
Minobamadizwin.
Yes. So I really like that one. Zaga Idewin for love. I don't know how they would say it in Manitoba, but out in this area, it's Zaga Idewin.
Zaga Idewin.
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 Yeah. Zaga Idewin.
Zaga Idewin.
Yeah. Zaga Idewin. So love. Dibadendizwin.
Truth.
Close.
Honesty.
You're getting there. Want to try again?
Yeah.
And it's one that we talked about.
Okay.
That should give you a
humility.
Humility. There you go. Diba.
Diba.
Den.
Den.
Dizwin.
Dizwin.
Yeah. Diba den dizwin.
Diba den dizwin.
Yeah. Humility.
Oh. Beautiful.
Yeah. So I like, those are the ones that stick out for me anyway.
Awesome. Where can people get the song?
Well, it'll be live on Spotify.
Perfect.
For sure. And I got to get it up on SoundCloud.
Miigwech, thank you.
You're welcome. Bama pi.
From her debut album back in 2007, this is Cheyenne Havorka with Black Thunderbird.
I understand the words coming from the sky. My wings are broken, but my heart is strong. I'll fly again and sing the sky my songs. The storm will hide me in its symphony. The sounds and lights will always comfort me. And I wonder, and I cry, how can I hear, how can I?
Jimmy Gwetch for hanging out with us today on Words and Culture. These are the Anishinaabe episodes, and this is our fourth. It means a lot to have you here, so I'm inviting you back. I hope you have a beautiful day, and like I learned last time, Naganj, or later.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin.
Soko seni denit e. Ninen yuji shina.
Eko se.